she couldn't hold a cell phone in her hands. The pain was really intense. And there was one night where she just woke up crying. She woke me up and she felt desperate. She was already having like depression. She told me, Fernando, like, let's try this carnivore thing. Like, if it worked for Michaela, maybe it can work for me. And I was like, yeah, let's do it. Very next day, got into the carnivore diet, and it was amazing. She regained control of her life. She suspended all her meds the next day as well, everything. Everyone looks at me like I'm crazy. I haven't had anyone yet so far to think that I'm doing the right thing. They think I'm probably murdering patients. I have patients come to me literally saying that I helped change their life. Like, that just feels really good, and it really makes you want to keep on doing it more and more and more. So it's been a lot more rewarding. I was actually getting disappointed with medicine. I was even thinking of doing a career change.
All right. Hey, guys, welcome. We've got Dr. Fernando Morales with us today, who's going to share with us some of his expertise. Where are you located, just out of curiosity?
I'm in Chihuahua, Chihuahua. It's a city in northern Mexico.
Yeah, I've heard of the dog, too. Just kidding. We have the little Chihuahua dogs. But anyway, is that where you grew up? Are you from there originally, or where did you?
Yeah, raised here. Actually, I lived in the United States for 10 years, okay. Georgia, actually.
In Georgia. What were you doing in Georgia?
My parents, my dad's work led us there. So I grew up there as a kid, came back to Mexico to study.
And so what exactly do you practice these days?
Well, I'm a general practitioner. I have my own private practice. So I began the carnivore diet in July last year, 2022. And I began implementing the carnivore diet this year. In February, actually. So I do general medicine alongside the carnivore diet with my patients.
Got it. You say so you've done it yourself personally, July of 2022. So about a year and not quite a year and a half. And you've been implementing it within your own practice. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, correct.
What compelled you personally to start on this crazy, wacko, weird, bizarre, I've heard everything, unscientific diet. What got you started on that?
It all started in 2021. We heard from, when I say we, I refer to my wife and I. So we heard about it in 2021 from Jordan Peterson, actually. And it sounded really wacky, like crazy. And the way he was describing it, it sounded like very restrictive and like some type of torture, like being like eating only meat. So we concluded that it was basically only for like extreme cases, like people with autoimmune issues. So we left it at that. But the interesting story here is that my wife is actually one of the main reasons I got into the carnivore diet, like head on. So to understand that, I have to more or less explain her story. She had been suffering from migraine since her infancy, around 5-6 years old. Now that's very rare. Her parents would take her to the doctor's office and they would say she's acting out, because it's very rare for a child to develop a migraine. That's more of something that happens in your adolescence, young adult years. So she was later on in life diagnosed with migraines. In that moment, she was taking topiramate to control the frequency and the intensity of the migraines. And she had been on it for already like around a year, more or less, on and off. And by 2022, the beginning of it, like her migraines started getting a lot more intense, like way more intense, incapacitating. Like she would be incapacitated 3-4 days every single week. And the frequency was literally every single week. So we started going with specialists. They started increasing her dosages, adding more medicine for her to take. We went with, even with up, but by then she started developing some articular pain, a neuropathic type of pain in her joints, started in her right elbow, then right wrist, then left elbow, left wrist. We even went with a rheumatologist to see if like it was an autoimmune condition, but nope, everything was perfectly fine. He did a order sonography to be done on her joints. There seemed to be inflammation like gathering around the joints, like according to what the radiologist reported. But then he referred us to an orthopedic surgeon. He did. He thought it was some peripheral nerve compression, so he sent us with a neurophysiologist to do electromyographies. They're poking her skin with these needles to check out if there's any peripheral nerve compression. She did it twice, and everything was clear. No peripheral nerve problems there. She told us, this doctor, that if there was any problem, it would be somewhere in the central nervous system, because peripheral, everything was nice and clear. And then this doctor, this orthopedic surgeon, just said, okay, we just got to operate your neck. Like my wife was in her late 20s. And we were shocked, like, why? There's like no indication whatsoever. My wife is also a general practitioner. And like, we don't understand this random indication. So we just brushed it off. And my wife, she just had to live with this. She couldn't hold a cell phone in her hands. The pain was really intense. So she had to choose between this type of pain, neuropathic pain, or terrible migraines. And there was one night where she just woke up crying. She woke me up and she felt desperate. She was already having like depression. She was really bad, in a bad place in that moment. So she told me, Fernando, let's try this carnivore thing. Like, if it worked for Michaela, maybe it can work for me. And by then I was already hearing, I hear a lot of Seyfeddin Amous's work. And on his podcast, I heard you were on once, and Dr. Bickman as well. So I was already convinced. Like, I was already starting to get convinced. But then my wife asked me for this favor and I was like, yeah, let's do it. Very next day, got into the carnivore diet. That was literally July of last year. And it was basically that. My wife was the main reason I got into it. And it was amazing. Like, she regained control of her life. She suspended all her meds the next day as well, everything. Neuropathic pain went away. Her migraines did not return. And she was a whole new person. Like, just amazing. Personally, my irritable bowel syndrome also just disappeared. Like, I thought that was just a condition I'd have for the rest of my life. I thought that was like, you can't do anything about it. You just take meds for when you have symptoms and that's it. And it just disappeared. And then like my chronic fatigue, gone. I even got into jiu-jitsu, feeling it with this new ramped up energy I was feeling. So that's basically the reason why I got into the carnivore diet. But we did for 3 months, as everyone recommends, Dr. Ken Barry. And we had a trip in November of last year, and hotels, you can't really, it's hard to follow the carnivore diet that way. We broke the diet for 3 whole months. And all our symptoms came back. Her migraines came back. My irritable bowel syndrome came back. And then February of this year is when we restarted everything. And I felt super motivated to share this with my patients. And it's been an amazing journey since then.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's all, in retrospect, it's probably glad you broke it and then reconfirmed that it was actually the diet that had such an impact, because it could be, it was just chance. I mean, it comes to, well, you just got lucky. It was chance and the diet had nothing to do with it. When clearly, if you start the diet, your symptoms go away, you go off the diet, they come back, and you do that multiple times, it becomes pretty clear to pretty much anybody that that has a big impact on that. And both of the conditions, or the conditions you've described with the migraines and the neuropathic pain and the IBS and so on and so forth, I've seen that with carnivore getting better many times. So it's clearly, interestingly, IBS is very common. I think it's even more common in Mexico, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's a very common diagnosis. And I keep telling people, just rename IBS to, instead of irritable bowel syndrome, we'll call it you're eating our own damn food. That's really what I said the disease should be renamed to. It's described what it actually is. And so, you know, what were you eating before all this? What was your wife eating? You guys probably eating a similar diet. I imagine you share the same household. But what was the diet that led to all this sort of negative health outcomes?
Actually, I'm Mexican. She's Latvian. So she's from Northeastern Europe. So our diets were completely different. I wouldn't know if completely different. But like my diet as a Mexican, it's a lot of processed food. Like we love to eat our burritos, tortas, and all this deep fried and vegetable oils. Definitely a lot of grain. Like we make fun of Central Mexicans. We eat a torta de tamal, which is basically a lot of dough. And then you put it between two pieces of white bread. So it's like a carb attack. So that was basically my diet. It was a lot of grains, a lot of beans, obviously, stereotypical. And as for my wife, she was always a bad eater. She was eating a lot of processed food, a lot of McDonald's. She was never fat or anything, but she had a terrible diet, a lot of processed food, basically. So that was our diet before the carnivore diet. And one thing I would like to ask you about, though, is one thing I've noticed personally from my own private practice. So I see it's easier for men to follow like a strict carnivore diet, just meat. And as for my wife and my female patients, I see for them, it's like they have to add like some fruit or some like something to give the meat some flavor, like just anecdotal cases. But I like your take on that.
My spouse, similar, she was a vegetarian when I first met her years ago. But she was like transitioning away from vegetarianism because she had just awful gut issues. And she has transitioned over the years. And now she is probably 90 5% carnivore, but she'll still have a little bit of fruit, a piece of avocado from time to time. Obviously, women, there are, obviously, as you're well aware, there are differences physiologically between men and women. Women tend to have more body fat than men, so they just may have a little bit higher energy requirement, perhaps, or at the very least, a higher fat percentage. Some women tend to maybe do a little better with a little bit more fat in their diet than men do, or energy in general. So that may be the carbohydrate thing. And of course, there's always been the social conditioning that most women have been subject to. It's you need to be small as possible, eat lots of salads and that type of stuff. So there may be, social conditioning. There may be, there clearly are physiologic differences. And I do not infrequently see that some women will say, you know, and it may revolve around menstrual cycles that they have different sort of energy requirements. And so at the end of the day, I do what's working for you. If she's able to stave off her migraines and feel great and add a little bit of fruit in there, there's nothing wrong with that in my view. I think that's completely fine. This isn't a religious type of thing. This isn't a dogmatic, you must only eat meat. It's ultimately, I think meat is an incredible health food. I think it's probably one of the healthiest food. I think in my view, it is the healthiest thing we can eat of all the foods that we can choose from. And the more of it we eat, the generally the better. But it's not to say that some people do a little better or feel better or just make it, maybe it's more sustainable for them just psychologically to have that little bit of, you know, fruit.
Yeah, actually, this diet also being an elimination diet, like that's one of the main things that my patients tell me. It's that they didn't realize certain foods cause certain issues for them. For example, my wife discovered that lactose and obviously vegetable oils are what triggers her migraine almost definitely. I also discovered that lactose, for me personally, gives me dandruff, like really intense dandruff. So I think that's like also another fantastic thing about the carnivore diet. You find out little bits and pieces of like your own diet, like what you should eat.
Yeah, it's like I said, if you're assuming that there's something in the diet that is leading to X, Y, or Z condition, but you're eating 100 things, is really challenging to isolate. And what if there's two things causing the same issue? When you only isolate one of them or eliminate one of them, you still got another one that's causing a problem. So by going carnivore and being very selective and very minimizing what you're consuming, it's much easier to tell the impact of individual foods and how they affect you. So yeah, for sure. There used to be a game called Clue. I don't know if you ever heard of that or played. It was like you had all these characters and it was a murder scene and it was Colonel Mustard in the library with a candlestick. You had to keep asking questions to figure out who did it. And it took you a long time. But if there was only one character and one weapon, it'd be pretty easy to figure out who did it because that's the only choice you have. And so, yeah, it definitely simplifies because a lot of the food sensitivity tests, that maybe an allergist might provide, the skin prick test, has been shown to be not particularly helpful. It's not particularly accurate. I've seen a lot of people say, I had a skin sensitivity test that said I couldn't eat red meat, but I tolerate it fine. I think this is really the best way to solve those issues, quite honestly.
Yeah, I totally agree. One thing that I think it will help.
Oh, go ahead. Oh, go ahead.
No,
I was going to ask you. I was going to ask you. So in February, you said you felt more confidence to start applying with your patients. And so, how did you reach the decisions you're going to do that? And how has it been received by your patients?
So the decision was basically because of my own personal experience. I realized, oh my God, like this thing solves problems. Like it solved my wife's problem. My wife, like you should have seen her. Like she looked like a 60-year-old. She had a crap load of different medications she was taking in her late 20s. And seeing all that just go away, like disappear. And her lifelong condition of migraine and my lifelong condition of irritable bowel syndrome just disappear. I was convinced. And by then, obviously, I was reading and hearing podcasts and videos. Yourself, Dr. Ken Berry, Dr. Anthony Chafee, Saifedean Moose talks about it very vividly as well. So from that, I felt the complete confidence, like this is going to work. I don't see how it won't. And once I started giving this advice, these recommendations to my patients, like almost everyone looks at me like I'm crazy. But in Mexico, it's very common for people to try like alternative medicine, like herbs and homeopathic medicine. So I think that's a little plus side here in Mexico. Like people will believe in these things a lot more, I think, than maybe in the United States. Plus, in northern Mexico, we have, and it's in the culture to have carnes asadas, which is basically barbecues. Like it's very common for every weekend, people to get together and just fry steaks and just, so I think that's been a big plus and the adoption. Like people look at me like I'm crazy, but then they tell me, it's cool. If what you say is true, then I'm already basically a carnivore. Because they love meat. But I always tell them that it's not that meat has magical properties in itself. Like if you just add meat to what you're already eating, it's not going to make anything magically go away. It's what you're eliminating. that's like the most impactful thing. And it's those patients who actually listen to me, who actually take the chance to do these things, they report the most biggest results. Actually, I already have a couple of patients who have successfully reverted, treated some of their chronic conditions. And alongside you, I'm going to start this carnivore month in January, like the 1 month carnivore challenge. I already got a group with some successful patients, plus people who are willing to try it out. And I don't know anyone else in Chihuahua, other general practitioners or doctors who do these type of interventions, but I'm hoping to start creating a community here. And I'm hoping that way a lot of people will start piling up on this way of eating, this traditional way of eating. Yeah.
It is definitely grown in tremendously. This will be the seventh year that I've done this World Carnivore Month. I started it back 7 years ago because I did not like the fact that Veganuary, the vegan month, was in January, which is when my birthday is. And I was like, I'm going to make that a carnivore month. And so we've started that. Now there's literally hundreds of thousands of people around the world that try this now. So it's interesting. And it's a good intro into that to see. Let me ask you, with regard to the patients, you say some of them are willing to do this. Is there any sort of, can you say a type of patient, like an older patient, a younger patient that's got a lot of diseases, who's most likely to be receptive to the message and actually do it in your experience, or can you make a comment on that?
Yeah, actually, most people I get are not exactly young people. Like, they're usually people around their 40s, like people who I've seen are trying it out. Yeah, people around their 40s, more or less. But I got people from both extremes. I got young people who have already been trying the carnivore diet. They just didn't know if they were doing it right. And they end up coming with me to help guide them a bit. And obviously, I refer them to, I just repeat basically what other doctors are in this space who have much more experience are doing. But I do see that a lot of elderly people, like here in Mexico, I don't know how it is in the United States. I think from what I hear, like a lot of people have lost faith in their own, their healthcare system. A lot of trust has been lost regarding the doctor-patient relationship. But here in Mexico, like there's people still, especially elder people, still see the doctors as like some type of leader, or I don't know how to put it. They see them with like some respect. So like when you give them some advice, they take it at heart. And they actually, I see that the older people are very receptive of these new ideas. So it's actually, there isn't like a group exactly that's more willing to take on this diet. But I do really, I see that more people around their 40s, more or less.
Yeah, it's often people that have experienced enough pain, because most 20-year-olds, they feel pretty good and they're like, I'll just eat whatever I want. And but once you start accumulating the damage, then you're, wait a minute, I don't feel very good. I don't want to spend the rest of my life in this condition. And so they have to have a sufficient amount of pain or a pain point that allows them to be willing to change that. What sort of conditions have you seen personally as a physician within your own practice respond to this diet?
So far, since I really started in February, it's like the most common conditions: diabetes, hypertension, skin conditions, migraines, irritable bowel syndrome, acid reflux. Nothing extreme yet. I have had some patients with autoimmune disease who I've really been trying to encourage to try this out, because I feel that would be like an amazingly, like, also like personal experience to see how to handle these type of patients. But so far, none of them have stuck with it. One of the main complaints I get is that it's really expensive. So I try to tell them that you don't have to be eating like ribeyes every single day. Like, you can eat a minced beef, for example, or even if all you can afford are like processed meat, like wieners and whatnot, like even that has more nutritional value, depending on what type of wieners you get, has more nutritional value than the best super fruit or super veggie. Like, you could like start small and slowly start going up. And I try to explain to them like the long-term costs of this. Like, it's actually cheaper if you take care of your health, and the time, also your own time, is saved instead of being in the hospital all the time or in waiting in line to get medical attention. But yeah, that's the main complaint I hear.
When you said diabetes, what kind of improvements have you noticed? You've seen significant decreases in hemoglobin A1C, able to come off medication. What kind of things have you seen with diabetes?
Yeah, exactly. They start getting off medication, especially the ones, the insulin, for example. That's one of the first things they start lowering the dosage of until they completely eliminate it. And hemoglobin A1C goes down. Their insulin levels also start regulating. It's just magical, and they don't believe it. So, but I order a basic metabolic panel, insulin levels and everything, in the beginning. And then after 3 months, I ordered that again. So like they can see themselves the improvements over time. But I think even more important than that, they physically feel better. Like they lose weight. Their brain fog goes away. So that's what I see in people with diabetes mainly. They just get better in general, like everything. They regain their life.
Yeah, friend, and I've seen that myself, and it's just consistent across. It doesn't matter what part of the world you're in. I guess I will reference that because you said in Mexico there's a particular just dietary preference. There's different foods. Do you have to, like, with carnivore, are there any particular foods that you emphasize for people? I know you mentioned carne asada, basically barbecued meat, basically. But how do you introduce it to people? What do you tell people to eat?
So basically, I tell them, like, in the carnivore diet, you can eat anything that's meat, basically seafood, pork, chicken, red meat. I'd always emphasize, though, that meat, kilo per kilo, it's like the most nutritious thing you can eat as a human. So I like try to eat that as much as you can, but you can eat any other type of meat, no problem. Eggs, people like hear like, chicharrón prensado. It's a type of pork. It's like bacon in a way. I give them like little tips. And for those who want to add like some flavor, because it's very typical. Everyone knows like Mexicans like spicy food or adding like special like toppings or spices to their food. I say, yeah, you can add maybe a little bit of jalapenos, but not like large portions, just enough to give it some flavor. That's what I recommend initially so that they can like slowly start weaning off their highly processed diet. And then a lot of, from what I've noticed, men themselves with time end up like eliminating all these extra chiles and things like these things that they add to give the food flavor because they realize that those things are actually making their reflux. Like here, it's very common in Mexico for people to suffer from acid reflux. It's like one of the most common conditions. It's amazing the amount of patients who are on omeprazole. Like they start feeling some reflux, they take omeprazole and they keep on drinking alcohol, their beers and eating chile. And them, it's surprise how they just have to eliminate certain things and all these medications just disappear.
Yeah, it's interesting, particularly with the omeprazole, the other proton pump inhibitors. They're only designed to be taken for a very short period of time. And yet you have people taking these for even decades, years and years and years, and they have significant downside effects as far as bone mineral density and dementia and some of these other things that have been associated with that. So it's good to be able to get those people off that. Now, you mentioned your wife is also a general practitioner. Do you guys practice together or are you part of a group or how does your practice set up?
We met in an exchange in Europe. So she graduated first and then she came to me. I graduated med school and then I went to her and then we moved back to Mexico. She can't practice here. She hasn't done any. She decided to stick with being a mom. We have two children, third one on his way. So she decided to stay as a stay-at-home mom, homeschooling children. And she helps me, though. She does like social media and she helps me with organizing my schedule and whatnot and sharing her experience.
So within, and I'm not sure how big Chihuahua is. I'm sure there's a lot of people there. I don't know the exact numbers, but other physicians within your community, because you refer patients to other specialists and as a GP, you would clearly do that. Do any of them know that you're doing carnivore or promoting that? And has there been any sort of, what the hell are you doing to my patients type of thing or what any of that type of stuff?
Yeah, there has been. Before I started my private practice, I was working in this government municipal clinic. So they actually have a diabetes department, like people with chronic conditions, well, not just diabetes, like chronic conditions like hypertension and whatnot. And I would be like a backup doctor. If a doctor couldn't go or was on vacation, I would cover for them. And being a young, naive person, I would begin doing the terrible mistake of feeling like, oh no, I have a solution for these people's problems. I have to implement that. I have to tell them about it. So these patients would come to me and I would talk to them about the carnivore diet, but you know, they're not my patients. I'm just covering there. Usually my job was just to give them their insulin, like just basically give them, refill their prescription and then send them on their way. But I would try to give them like the whole talk. And that would create some friction later on because obviously like I would go away, the doctor would come back and they would have a consultation with them within 3-6 months later. And I'm pretty sure they would start telling this doctor about what I told them. And when I would go back to this hospital, I could sense like this tension. No one ever told me anything directly, but people stopped talking to me. Yeah, everyone looks at me like I'm crazy. I haven't had anyone yet so far to think that I'm doing the right thing. They think I'm probably murdering patients. I have heard from some patients, though, that there's a doctor or two there, like a bariatric surgeon around here who does implement a low-carb diet. I've been meaning to get in contact with her, but I think we're very few and far between who actually implement something like this.
Hopefully the numbers are going to grow. They are growing here in the U.S. I know they are. We hear more of them all the time. And as the evidence becomes more and more clear, and the good news is there are studies that are being done and will be done. I'm actually putting funding teams together with researchers to do particularly studies on diabetes and autoimmune disease. So hopefully hold tight for that. Hopefully that'll come in. So at least you have a little bit more ammunition to show either your patients or your colleagues that, hey, there is actual credible scientific literature on this stuff, which is, I think, so incredibly important for someone in your position, because it can be even scary to take this sort of contrary position, even though the results are what they are. And clearly, you've experienced for yourself, your wife has experienced it. I'm sure you've had patients that have experienced it. So you know that it, at least in some instances, it works quite well. Did you have losing weight personally, or did you have a change in your own? I know that you said the IBS is better, the chronic fatigue was better, but any sort of physical changes that people could see when they saw you?
Oh, yeah, sure. Actually, I don't know if I can do a screen share here and show some pictures. Okay, so I'm sharing this random picture here. Can you see that?
Yes. Yeah, that's you. Yeah. Is that your wife next to you with kind of reddish
hair?
That's
my wife. Okay. Yeah. I weighed around 93 kilos in that photo.
Okay.
Currently, okay. I'm 73 kilos. So that's 20. That's 20 kilos lost.
And you gained a beard too.
And I became more masculine. Yeah. Yeah. That's me right there also. And okay. Now I do jujitsu because of the extra energy I got. I've never been in a better condition in my whole life. Like, I'm in my late 20s right now, but during my most of my 20s with med school and everything, I fell out of shape. I felt terrible. And I thought like this chronic fatigue I was feeling was simply something that medicine left me with. I'm just screwed up now. But wow, I just feel so alive right now. So the amount of energy and life pumped back into me is just amazing. You really do lose some years.
A lot of physicians, myself included, felt you get a little bit burned out by medicine. You get tired of seeing the same old people not getting better, particularly, I'm sure, in the general practice. Just you feel like, you said, I'm there just to refill prescriptions all day long, like in the diabetes clinic. Has your enjoyment in your own personal practice improved since you've implemented this style of approach?
Yes, and truly my best. I feel the best when I have a metabolic patient get better. I see a lot of colds, gastroenteritis, a lot of acute conditions, and it gets tiring. It's repetitive. You're just treating symptoms. You don't feel like you're doing anything impactful. But when you see people come to you and give you, like, I have patients come to me literally saying I help change their life. Like, that just feels really good, and it really makes you want to keep on doing it more and more. So it's been a lot more rewarding. I was actually getting disappointed with medicine a few years ago. I was even thinking of doing a career change. But after this, I think the fact that you feel like you're doing something impactful, that really helps a lot, in my opinion. I think a lot of general practitioners could also get a revive in their passion for medicine, like their reasons for studying in the first place, if they were to adopt these type of practices.
Yeah, I think when most of us go into medicine with the underlying impression we are going to actually help people, and then you get into practice and you realize, all I am is a technician handing out prescriptions. You lose some of the, there's some thought that goes into it. And you're like, what's the right drug for this condition? But ultimately, you feel like, am I really making much of a difference? And now you probably feel like, yeah, I'm really making a real difference in these people's lives. And that's what, as I was a surgeon for many years, yes, when I operate on somebody, it impacted their life and it made a difference and hopefully it improved them. But it pales in comparison to what I feel like I'm able to accomplish now with just good lifestyle advice, really good nutrition advice. It's so much interesting, so much more interesting. How hard is it in Mexico to do a carnivore diet? Is it hard to get quality meat? Is it hard to get the things you want? I think some people say in some places yes, some places no. But what's your experience where you're at locally, and I guess in Chihuahua?
Yeah, so like northern Mexico, it's like super super easy. Like, meat is part of our culture. Like beef beef is part of our culture. We have a lot of large cattle and big ranges for them to graze on. So it's like not a big problem at all in northern Mexico. Nonetheless, in southern Mexico, it is a lot more tougher. Like down there, their main source of meat is pork, and beef is really expensive down there. And for them, I think it would be a lot more tough for them to eat red meat, mainly pork. Central Mexico, it's a lot more, they eat a lot more grains and stuff like that, but they can get meat fairly easy. The industrial part of Mexico is in around the center, so there's a lot more easy access to products. But I think northern Mexico, it's fantastic opportunity for a lot of Mexicans to change their lives.
What about cost-wise? Is it costly prohibitive? Is it like way more expensive? Or I've been to Mexico a few times, just mostly the tourist areas. I've never really been to like probably real Mexico, but and I recall they had good beef and it wasn't that expensive. Certainly no more than going out to eat in a U.S. probably cheaper than going out to eat in a U.S. restaurant. So what is the relative cost, particularly given the average person's income where you're at?
Yeah, that's the thing though. The average income here in Mexico is a lot lower than in the United States. It is pricey. Like for example, minced beef, you can find it around between 80 to 100 pesos a kilo. If I do the quick conversion here at 80 pesos per kilo, that's $4.50 per kilo.
That would be cheaper than the U.S. as far as ground beef. That's probably half the price of the U.S. ground beef. So that's not bad.
Okay. Yeah. And for like grass-fed ribeye, I found it at $19.40 per kilo here in Chihuahua.
So it's about 10 bucks a pound. So that's or just under 10 bucks. That's probably equivalent in some places, maybe even a little cheaper than the U.S. But again, you got to put in the cost of living and the actual income that the average person has, which would be much less probably in Mexico compared to the U.S. So when you see people and let me ask you personally, when you made the transition to carnivore and your wife, did either of you guys experience any significant negative sort of, because you sound like it was pretty positive, but were there any negatives that went with that?
No. Yeah, I had a lot of diarrhea, but I was also drinking coffee. So when I started cutting off the coffee, the diarrhea just disappeared. So the problem was the coffee, not exactly the meat. I've been on and off coffee since I started the carnivore diet.
So when you bring the coffee back in, does the diarrhea return?
Okay. Yeah, I get a lot of bowel problems. As for my wife, negatives, nope. Basically, she's had zero negatives when she's on a carnivore diet or very low carb diet. Yeah, my main problem was that diarrhea. And actually, that's been the main complaint from my patients as well, diarrhea. And they think that constipation is when you go less frequently. Like they're surprised that after not eating a lot of fiber and not going very frequently, they think that's a problem. But I explained to them that it's not.
Yeah, it's just one of those things where you got to realize you don't have to go to the bathroom. Bowel movements two or three times a day. It can be every other day or even less frequently and still be fine. And it's not constipation. It's just you just don't have as much waste material to get rid of. Mm-hmm. Do you find that, you said you had IBS. Were you on any kind of medication for IBS? I know there's people that sometimes take different meds for IBS. Were you medicating yourself or having somebody medicate you for IBS?
No, I would usually just take it. I was constipated. I'd be constipated, diarrhea, I'd have diarrhea. Had any pain or bloating, I'd just
dealt with it. Yeah, and I think it's such a common. I know in the U.S., like I said, it's something like 15-20% of our population has it. I've read that in Mexico, it's even higher, which you may be able to confirm or deny that. But what about, how about mentally, cognitively, mood-wise? Did you notice any changes with changing your diet?
Personally, I felt more energetic and according to my wife, I was a lot less grumpy, but I guess that has to do with the fact that you're less tired. When you feel energetic and not exhausted, I guess you're just in a general better mood. My wife definitely improved. She had depression, like pretty bad depression, and that just went away. For her, it was super noticeable, her mood changes. It was amazing.
Now, you said she's now being a stay-at-home mom, if I'm correct in what I heard, and you got a couple kids. Are the kids' diets meat-based, or how do you do that?
Yes. Yeah, so right currently we're changing homes, but we're remodeling the home. We're about to move in, so we're staying with my parents' house for now. And with us, when we were in our own separate house, they were eating basically carnivore, low carb, some fruits, vegetables here and there. They love fruits a lot. They love dairy too, but that was basically their diet. Here with their grandparents, unfortunately, it's really hard to control the diet here. They're eating a lot of pasta and pizza, and we don't like it, but since we're only here temporarily, we're allowing it for now. I've been trying to educate my parents into doing this. My dad doesn't want to change. My mom has at least eliminated seed oils. But it's really hard for people to change their habits, especially if they're not, like, as you referred to previously, if they're not suffering. Because it's those people who are suffering the most who are the most willing to do the most drastic changes.
I don't know the, and maybe you have some insight, or maybe you're not even old enough to know this, but obviously, just like the American diet has transitioned into this more ultra-processed garbage, I'm sure the Mexican diet has as well. Were there some traditional, like, cooking fats? You mentioned seed oils. This is something that some people demonize, other people think there's nothing wrong with it, it's controversial, but has there been a shift in what was it in the old days that butter and lard and tallow was used in Mexican cooking, and now it's been replaced with margarine and soybean oil? Or what's happened over time in Mexico, or do you know?
Yeah, so I've actually talked about this with my own grandma and my older patients. So yeah, like back then it was definitely a lot more common to use pig fat, lard. That was very common. They would use seed oils back then. And my grandma says, yeah, they would use it all the time back. She was born around 1945. Her parents were using seed oils, but definitely also a lot of lard. So it has always been apparently part of the Mexican culture to use some seed oils, but it seems that it was at least on par with lard.
Yeah, always, as in since it had been invented in the late 1800s. Yeah. It's only been around that long. And so that's longer than both you and I have been alive, but it's not long on a sort of a human existence scale, for sure. What are, as far as I've seen, the U.S. in particular is bad in the fact that we allow drug advertisements on TV. I think United States and New Zealand are the only two companies in the world that allow that. I've seen that now in South America, not in Mexico, it's part of Central America, but South America, North America still, sorry, my bad. But in South America, I know there's been pushes to eliminate ultra-processed food in some of the countries. I can't remember which ones, maybe, I don't know, Uruguay or things like that. I saw in Mexico, there was a period of time where they tried to make candy or sodas like difficult for little kids to consume or so. Is there still that sentiment going on? What's the nutrition climate like in Mexico? Are they all on board as much processed food as possible? Or are they trying to rein that in?
Well, they tried that a few years ago. They tried to increase taxes on these ultra processed foods. And they started putting these big labels because no one reads the nutritional label on the back. On the very front part of every single box of Skittles or whatnot, these big labels saying like excess sugars, excess calories. But I haven't really seen much of a big push on part of the government or the society at large to try to eliminate ultra-processed food. It's just unfortunately part of the culture. Like, it's very common for a Mexican after work or at night to go out for a snack. And they make these, you get a giant plate of chips with salsas and candies. And it's just littered with a bunch of ultra-processed garbage. And that's just very common. You take your girlfriend out to to have these things on a date and stuff. It's like very common here. So that's the unfortunate side of things.
Is there a war on meat in Mexico like there is in other places in Europe, United States to some degree? They're like pushing everybody to go plant-based. Is there a Mexican like dietary guidelines committee like there is in the U.S. and they're saying we need to all get away from meat and go plant-based? Is that feature much down there, or are you still pretty traditional?
I haven't heard any of that yet. I do know that in the bigger cities, Mexico City, Monterrey, Guadalajara, these movements are a lot more bigger, people pushing for more plant-based, sustainable type of movements. But Mexico's like Chihuahua, we always say it's just one big ranch still. It's a city, but like people are more conservative in ways. But yeah, it's mostly in the big cities where you see those type of things.
Yes, it's like living on a giant cattle ranch. It's probably a good place to be, quite honestly. What, in your mind, is the biggest difficulty within your practice to get people to be successful on this? Is it lack of resource, lack of information? If you could design the ideal practice and have unlimited, I have as much money as I want to spend, how would you change things?
That's a really good question. But yeah, first of all, starting out with the main complaints, totally. It's expensive. Meat is expensive here for the average Mexican. And so that's number one complaint. Number two, there's not enough information in Spanish. Like I tried Googling dieta carnívora, like carnivore diet in Spanish, and I get almost nothing. I get some random YouTube channels talking about it. certain videos, but there's no channels like in the United States dedicated to the carnivore diet. So there's a huge lack of information. I'm trying to change that. I started a YouTube channel a few months ago, but if I had unlimited resources, I would totally try to do that. Spread information as far and wide as possible, create an intense marketing campaign, basically, to get people aware of this. And I think you have to point out the lies first, brought to you by the industry, the food industry. The book, The Fiat Food, which recently came out, that's an amazing book I want to translate and make videos about. So if I had money, I would like do mass publicity on that, because people have to identify the problem first. Because you offer them a solution first, but they still have all these misconceptions in their mind. It's going to be very hard for them to change their mind to begin with. So I would do marketing campaigns, and I don't know, I guess I invest also in regenerative farming, like try to bring beef prices down. But
yeah, and I forget his last name, but there's a guy, his first name is Alejandro, and I don't remember his last name, but he's a regenerative rancher in Chihuahua, I believe, in the region. And I know he's like greening the desert out there. So obviously it's probably very deserty, and he's able to, with his cattle practices, he's actually, at least in the, not in the hot, dry months, but in the rest of the year, he has like wide grass growing. And so it's quite interesting that you can change that. And it actually changes the microclimate to where it rains more, because it's interesting. Because as the cows, as the soil gets better and it holds on to more moisture, goes up and comes back down in the form of rain. So you can actually change the local climate with properly managed cattle. So it's very interesting things. Do you find that... So you talked about what would you do like on a big scale, but just individually for a patient, what does a patient need to be successful? Can you just hand them a flyer and say, go to town? Or do they need a lot of support? Do they need hand-holding, coaching? What do you think it takes for the average person to be successful?
From my personal and limited experience, again, I barely began this year, and I definitely see it's hand-holding. But I think not just hand-holding, creating a community. That's why I created like this little WhatsApp group where people can help support each other. Not just see that there's a wacko doctor recommending this, like seeing other people who have successfully done this. And the unfortunate part is that, yeah, there's not enough resources in Spanish. And a lot of my patients don't speak English. It was hand-holding initially because there was no information out there. But now that there's some successful cases, I think forming groups, communities, is going to be like the thing that makes this grow much, much more faster. So I think that's the thing.
Yeah, I've written a book on this, as you may know. And it's been translated into German and Hungarian. I think there's somebody trying to get the French rights. It seemed to make sense to do it in Spanish because, gosh, there's so many people that speak Spanish on Earth. It's like, I think, the third most common language in the world, if not, I think something like that. So people ask me for Spanish, and it's up to my publisher. My publisher's, I don't know, I'm not sure what to draw. I guess there's enough demand there, they can do that. So it's called Victory Belt Publishing for anybody that's inquiring about maybe that. Because I know, like somebody said, they contact the publisher and then there's something they have to do with the rights on translations and stuff like that. So that might be helpful. You said you started some social media. What are the social media channels that you have? Because there's people that follow me that speak Spanish, and maybe they have relatives that only speak Spanish. And so give me some resources that you have. And I assume you do your stuff in Spanish. Is that correct?
Correct. Yes. So I have a Twitter, Instagram, and a Facebook, and I run a YouTube channel. You can look for me in YouTube as at Fernando Morales MD. And from there, you can find all my social media.
Okay. So at Fernando Morales MD is where to find you and all your social media that's in Spanish for people that are trying to figure this out. Interesting. Have you had any, how has been your experience on social media, by the way? Because I get my share of detractors and people that think I look funny and smell bad and I'm stupid and all that stuff. I get that's whatever. I just laugh about that stuff. But has your interaction been largely positive, or what's been your experience?
I'm very small. Like I'm barely getting started. So fortunately, I still haven't had any of these negative encounters yet, but I'm definitely expecting this to happen eventually. If it starts to grow,
you've made it when you've got critics, you finally made it, right?
Yeah, I can imagine. Exactly. So I'll be waiting for that.
Yeah. Interesting. And your wife is she, you said she's helping you with the social media a little bit. Does she actually, does she speak Spanish? You said she's Latvian, but she now learned to speak Spanish and all that stuff.
Well, Spanish will be her fifth language. So she speaks English, Latvian, Russian, German, and is currently learning Spanish. I think she'd be a very valuable resource. So from her, I think we like to expand to Russian and
That's true. Yeah. It's interesting as you learn, and though I don't know how easy those languages translate to Spanish, maybe English would probably be the one that probably is the most applicable, I would imagine. But I know when I was learning French, then the Spanish made more sense because the constructions are very similar. And so it was interesting. My Spanish is minimal at best. So my English is barely good. So I'm certainly not a polyglot or whatever you want to call it. Okay. We got a couple more minutes left. Anything else that you'd like to share that we didn't get to touch on?
I would like to get your feedback on tips and tricks. What I want to recollect data from my patients, and I would love to help you out. Like, I don't know if there's any way I can help you out. Should there be certain like data points, things I should recollect?
Obviously the diabetes information is wonderful. I think that's checking hemoglobin A1Cs, and I don't know if you guys have access to CGMs that much down there, but those data points are always nice to show. This is the interesting thing for me is that a lot of critics of just low carb diets in general when it comes to diabetes will say that, yes, you've lowered their A1C. Yes, you've lowered their blood glucose, but you didn't really impact the disease. You're just masking it because you're not giving them the provocative carbohydrates. But what I see in conjunction with reductions in hemoglobin A1C, reduction in average blood glucose, reductions in medication use, which I think is huge, is that they also see resolution or improvement of these end organ issues that occur, like the chronic renal insufficiency, the diabetic retinopathy, peripheral neuropathy, those types of things that get better. So if you can document, like, for instance, because a lot of your patients that are diabetic probably have stage 1, stage 2 chronic kidney disease. And if you measure that properly using things like cystatin C rather than creatinine-based, because a creatinine-based measurement is going to be artificially inflated by the protein consumption. It doesn't really, so people that understand that, hey, you need to use cystatin C as a measure or directly measure, because both cystatin C and creatinine based are just estimates. So actually maybe showing reversal of kidney function or reversal of kidney damage would be really, I think, good to document. Obviously, blood pressure reductions, obviously body weight's important. Imaging, I don't know how much access you have to imaging, but cardiac imaging when it comes to is this, because the biggest concern is, and you may be paying attention to some of these new studies that have just come out, is that by eating more saturated fat, you're going to raise your LDL cholesterol, and therefore you're going to put yourself at higher risk for cardiovascular disease. And I think that is what people expect. That's not what we're typically seeing. We're actually seeing that doesn't seem to be the risk that we once thought it is. It's still, we don't have quite enough data to make that claim boldly, but I think it's certainly a serious question to the whole lipid hypothesis. And the more information we have on that, like I said, I've had a patient who's, I don't know how you deal with LDL cholesterol or ApoB or whatever you guys measure down there. As far as if someone comes in, they have high cholesterol, do you automatically put them on some kind of lipid lowering therapy? Or do you say, let's watch to see how you do. Let's get some imaging. I don't know what your approach to that might be, but that may be something to look into.
Yeah, most medical practitioners here in Mexico, they see the high LDL cholesterol statins right away. The typical comment is they're not going to do any lifestyle changes, so you might as well just give them statins right away. So yeah, people aren't very exhaustive here on measuring plaque.
Yeah, that's when you're probably in many cases they're right. People aren't going to do lifestyle change, and they're not going to do it without support, and they're not going to do it without something that's sustainable and enjoyable. So that's, in a way, that's true. However, it's like the easy way out. It's lazy. In my view, it's lazy medicine. And I think it's just being lazy, and that's what it is. And so if you want a physician that just says, here's a pill, because I don't think you're going to be able to do anything, a lot of patients will surprise you in what they're able to do, and particularly if they're given the right information and the right support level. So anyway, Fernando, thank you thanks for appearing, but thanks for doing what you're doing, because it takes courage. I had another physician who's like in Greece. He's like the only guy in Greece doing carnivore. And he's like, this could be a problem for my practice. They could come in and say, hey, you can't practice medicine anymore. So thanks for having the courage to do that. But there are more people every day that I see that are actually following the science, or following what actually is occurring on the ground, following the clinical results that we're seeing, which is, I think, really, when we talk about following the evidence, and then you, as you mentioned, fiat food, but there's fiat pharmacy as well. When the evidence is tainted and corrupted and controlled by conflicts of interest, how good is that evidence? Who does it benefit? So anyway,
all the money.
Thanks for doing that.